This is CliffCentral.com.
That's the voice of Shekina with Sketchy Bongo and Let You Know, Monday morning. The 3rd of October. Yeah, heard that right. You know, every now and then I get a book from somebody. Just an interesting, happy book. No ugly, complicated, nasty stuff around politics or the economy or any of that miserable stuff. And Luke Alfred has written just such a book. It's called One Sunday Morning, I Decided to Step Out and Find South Africa. He is here with us this morning, and it's time to see what this book is all about, because I think people need something to be happy about. Hey, Luke, welcome.
Morning.
Nice to have you here, man.
Thank you.
Good. So first of all, congrats on the book. It's getting rave reviews from everybody. And I think people just need something fun and positive and inspirational to look at. And you really have. You've taken an interesting look at South Africa. It's obviously also a bit of a story. So that's worth telling. But where do you even begin with this? How did it all start in your head? How did you decide to write something like this? You've written many other things.
Yeah, Gareth... Well, I'm now a writer and a freelance journalist, but my last sort of formal job as a journalist prior to a debacle when I worked for CSA for about 18 months was at the Sunday Times. And in 2012, the then editor of the Sunday Times was a guy called Ray Hartley.
Yeah.
And Ray and I had an idea while I was there to do something called History Walks, which was a plan to walk parts of the country, research the parts of the country you were going to walk so there was an available backstory,
yeah,
but walk them in sort of walk them in the now, in the contemporary, and see what you found and play off what you found on the ground with what you'd researched. And also the nice thing about walking is you can never always define or know who you're going to encounter. You meet strange people, you have interesting experiences. Yeah, it requires a certain sort of openness to the world, actually, which can't be scripted.
And we're only really discovering some parts of our history now, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was the idea. And to cut a long story short, that never transpired. I left, I went to another job. But it had always been in the back of my mind to do something similar. And there's a very interesting sort of zeitgeist with walking. You're not in a car. You're not in a train, you're not in an aeroplane.
And you're not in a hurry.
And you're not in a hurry, and there's a sense of meander. And the word meander can mean many things, and wander can mean many things. And in actual fact, you open yourself to experience, to elements, and that's quite interesting because, you know, a lot of what contemporary South Africa is about is the sort of, is the noise, is the white noise, which comes from knowing all the answers.
Yeah.
You reach a certain stage in your life where you realize, well, actually, I know less and less. I'm sure about less and less.
That's when they say that you know that you're actually, that you're intelligent, but you're admitting you're stupid.
Yes. Yes. I guess I'm one of those guys. I'm one of those intelligent, really stupid guys.
So is it true that you decided one day to just get up and explore this country?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Bearing in mind the sort of the backstory that I've given you and the spiel, you know.
All right, what happened to me yesterday, I remember both my grandfathers were in the Air Force.
Okay.
And my dad's father used to drive up to Bays Hill in Pretoria to the Air Force Memorial, which I'd never been to. You know, I'd driven past there a couple of times. I'd never seen it before. And I went up there and I took a look the other day. I just drove in. I had a bit of time. I was on my way back from something, and I drove in and I took a look. There was no one else there. It was deserted. It was absolutely quiet. There were some sprinklers going on the lawn, and I walked around and I read some of the names on the walls, and I you know, just for a minute there, I reflected on the fact that these are people who probably saved us from Nazism and a whole lot of other things. But there were modern memorials to people post 1994, who've been killed in active battle. And I know that they occasionally have Air Force events there and all the rest of it, but for that moment, it was all mine. It was quiet. It was deserted. It had a beautiful view across the whole, you know, the old Swartkop Air Force base and all the rest of it. I just thought, you know, there's so much history here. And I'm sure there are lots of places all over South Africa where you get that feeling. And you might have been the only person in many of these places at any given time, taking in some of the history, feeling some of the excitement of being in a special place that for a lot of people is just something they drive past on their way to work every day.
Did you read the Reconciliation Road chapter? Or should I tell you about it?
Tell me about it, okay, because so, I'd like to hear
So there's this amazing idea. It's called Reconciliation Road. It's a road between the Voortrekker Monument and Freedom Park. Okay, and it was officially opened by the president in 2011. Okay, there's a little plaque sort of on the border of the Voortrekker Monument. It's fascinating because it's actually built on an incredible amount of land.
Yeah.
So, and it's basically governed by a trust, if governed is the correct word.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, it's sort of a bottom of a little depression. There's a memorial to Jay-Z opening Reconciliation Road. Within a couple of years, it had been closed. Voortrekker Monument and Freedom Park couldn't agree on how they were going to handle the portion where their borders meet. And in fact, if you go there today, you'll see...
What an allegory for our
well, exactly.
Problems.
Isn't it the perfect metaphor? And if you go there today, what you'll find is it's a bit like an old border a Cold War border post in Berlin in the 1950s.
But they're on totally different hills,
or
right?
Or 60s. But they do meet through the road. So one of the final chapters here was about a walk from... And now this is very important. You need to walk from the Voortrekker Monument to Freedom Park. You can't walk the other way around. It would send the wrong political signs. So one of the last walks I did, was to gather all the people who I'd encountered on my 11 previous walks, wherever it was in the country, whether I'd walked in rural KZN I walked in Thomas Pringle country in the Eastern Cape. And not all of them were able to come, but I invited them all. We were going to walk from Voortrekker Monument to Freedom Park, which we did on Freedom Day in April. And we were able to do that because finally the respective authorities at Freedom Park and the Voortrekker Monument had sort of buried their differences and come together and said, isn't it a little preposterous that we share a border, but we're close to each other? And in a way, that is the perfect metaphor for contemporary South Africa. You know, there's touch, but there's no embrace. And this is the kind of thing I have to add in a kind of subtle way. This is not a hectoring. This is not a book which says you must feel good about South Africa.
No.
I think that's the wrong way to go about it.
Sure.
There's too much sort of facile sentimentalism about our calls to love your country. This is not this type of book,
right?
You know, but it is in a subtle kind of nuanced way. It is making a case for you know, we find ourselves here together. We better start finding ways of making it work.
How did that walk go?
It was a lovely walk, but, you know, you talked about your recent experiences at Swartkops and no one being there. We were alone.
Yeah, there was no one else.
We were alone.
You know, we've got Freedom Park is beautiful.
Yeah. So this is also, you know, this is
no
once again
there.
Coming back to the phenomenal apathy of contemporary South Africans.
Yeah.
You know, so we have these environments, we have these memorials, we have these heritage sites, Freedom Park, the Apartheid Museum, whatever it might be. Now, not only Freedom Park was empty, but the Voortrekker Monument was empty as well. The only people that were at the Voortrekker Monument were busloads of Chinese tourists who are very turned on by the Voortrekker Monument, strangely.
Yeah, that is pretty bizarre.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's sad in some way that people don't prioritize their own history. Because without understanding your own history, how will you know where you're going to? You've got to have a background to figure out your present.
I think it's a more subtle problem, if I might say that. I think that many people do prioritize their own history. They're interested, like you. You've just given the example, your family history. You're beginning to sort of be sensitized or be interested or be curious about your family history. So in terms of small pockets of people, families, ethnic groups, there is an understanding of history. But where it starts to get difficult in contemporary South Africa is when you have competing versions of history and you're dealing with the same events. And you see it's very interesting with the ANC, what the ANC have done. The ANC have either done by design or sort of arbitrarily as they've gone along. But a lot lot of sort of the politics of other parties in the apartheid days. The PAC would be a very good example. Yeah, one of the walks in the book, a guy called Philip Skosana, as a student, as a 23-year-old student in the early 1960s at UCT, he got a race relations bursary from where he lived, which is a hamlet north of Pretoria. He just got into UCT. Mm-hmm. He led a group of 30,000 migrant workers who marched on Parliament and the Rowland Street police station. People do know about it. It's part of the public and the historical record, but contemporary people and youngsters don't really know about it. And the wonderful thing about Skosana is he was so impecunious, he had so little money in his pocket, he had very little money for food and no money for clothes. He led a march of 30,000 far older men than he was in short pants. He walked in shorts. He was a sort of a proto Kortbrook character. And it went off. This was, now remember, this was in a period 10 days from Sharpeville. So the country was on high alert. People were petrified. There were armored cars lining part of the road that the march took place on.
I suppose the reason his story isn't more famous is probably because it hasn't been included in the canon of acceptable ANC party political history.
Exactly. He's still alive. I walked with him in the hamlet called Makapanstad where he grew up, and he showed me, well, this is the Presbyterian church, and my father carved, who was a carpenter who went to Woodstock to be trained in the 1950s. He carved the pulpit, and this is the grave. This is the community graveyard. And here are all these family members, and this lovely stuff. And this country is actually this is a bit of a bugbear of mine. But forgive me.
Let's hear it.
This country is very badly served by contemporary journalism, and one of the reasons it's badly served by contemporary journalism is that, firstly, a lot of journalists can't write. But secondarily, there's no curiosity. You know, this is a big country. You know, one of the things that's happening now is the 100th anniversary of Sol Plaatje, who's one of the great black intellectuals of this country. You're not seeing a lot of this in contemporary media or print media.
You'd think they'd be writing about it.
And we've come.
People are more interested in someone who we definitely won't remember 100 years from now, Claudie Motsoeneng.
Or Kim Kardashian.
Or Kim Kardashian. And here's this guy, Sol Plaatje, who did so much to advance black intellectualism at the time and even now.
Exactly. And one of the drivers for the book was sort of to actually say, hey, well, let's not accept the kind of contemporary wisdoms of the day. Let's actually just go out, let me go out and investigate this country for myself. Let me take myself into the boondocks or obscure patches of this country. You know, one of the chapters in this book is that Cry the Beloved Country. Mm. Reverend Stephen Kumalo comes up. He comes up to Johannesburg to look for his son, Absalom. And he needs to take a narrow gauge train before he joins the main line, the Midnight Thunder, to come up to Jozi, you know. And so this is Peyton's book in 1948. That narrow gauge railway line depicted in Cry the Beloved Country still exists. It's still there. And so I walked it. I walked it for 15 kilometers to see what I would see. You know, and there are all kinds of things like this in the book. And you know, I just hope it appeals to people and their sense of adventure.
And walking all this time, I mean, aren't you... Aren't you sometimes tempted to get on
go in an Uber or
to use motorized transport, because a lot of it you see interesting things, but you also along the way will encounter long patches of boring, dull, uninteresting space. You know, it is interesting how many places in South Africa are unexplored, though, because we do have these vast sort of natural reserves too, where you'll find artifacts of, you know, ancient civilizations of people who haven't existed in that area for thousands and thousands of years.
You don't, although it's tempting, you don't want to get in the car, because that changes your view and it changes your vision and takes it, you know, it doesn't take very long. And, you know, part of the reason why I walked this is because it provides opportunity for reflection.
That's graveyards. Tell me about graveyards, because a lot of people don't like going to them. I think they could be very, very interesting, especially if, you know, you stumble upon someone really historically significant in a graveyard.
Now look, the whole thing is you put your finger on something. You were quite perceptive in one of your previous questions, which is there's a problem with writing about the countryside while walking it. And the obvious problem is keeping the reader's attention. So I couldn't, you know, you have to be quite savvy to sort of, some walks have long periods of nothing, of boredom, of heat, of I'd rather not be here now. What on earth am I doing? So what I decided...
In those times, you at least hope that you've got interesting company.
Yeah, so what I decided to do was to offset that, to walk with other people.
Yeah.
But also, this book is not only about walking in contemporary South African history. There's quite a lot of autobiography in this book. There's quite a lot of literary reflection in this book. And you asked about graveyards. I mean, one of the walks I do is to the crematorium in which my late mother was cremated, which is a Hindu crematorium in Brixton. Yes. It's the first brick-built Hindu crematorium in the Southern Hemisphere. And it was campaigned for by Mahatma Gandhi.
Wow.
And he realized that some of his countrymen had nowhere to be cremated. And so in line with Hindu funeral practices and rituals, he impressed upon his friend, Hermann Kallenbach, who was a German architect, to design a crematorium. So one of the walks I did was, and I walked it with my old man, who is still alive. He's 79 years old, so he's not a very good walker. So we plodded along for a few kilometers, but we walked from Museum Africa to the Hindu crematorium in the Brixton Cemetery. And cemeteries are very, very interesting. They tell you quite a lot about, you know, I visited the Modderfontein Cemetery at the Dynamite Factory. That's the opening chapter. And what happened there at the turn of the last century, a whole lot of what were called cartridge girls, who were Italians, were blown sky high. They were in a packing room, and there was a terrible dynamite explosion. And the story of the Modderfontein Dynamite Factory is absolutely fascinating. But to cut to the chase, Paul Kruger needed to recruit laborers and artisans who had experience of working with dynamite in the 1890s. He couldn't find them locally. A lot of them came from Europe, from Inter Alia, from Italy, a place called the Vigliana, which was west of Turin. And the Italians came. They used their expertise in the early years of the factory. They lived on the company premises. But when they were able to save a little bit of money, they moved away. Where did they move to? They moved to Orange Grove. Orange Grove was called Little Italy once upon a time.
Oh, wow.
So I walked from Orange Grove, Little Italy, and I took the route that they might have taken to get to work to the Modderfontein Dynamite Factory. That was the first walk.
Well, if you think about it, humans have mostly walked throughout history.
Yes.
We only recently started to drive around or ride around.
Yes.
And therefore, you probably discover a lot more about the circumstances. See, in my head, I like to recreate what it must have been like a generation or two ago in any situation. Just try to imagine what it's like.
Yes.
And if you walk, I think you get a better feel for how those people's daily lives might have felt. And a lot of it would have been quite dull. I mean, walking to and fro, you know, just to and from work every day. We complain about traffic now, but it would have taken you a lot longer to walk from Orange Grove, to the dynamite factory.
Yes, and I mean, South African, there's a vein to be mined in South African history. Gandhi was an inveterate walker. So there was a period of Gandhi's life when he lived in South Africa. He lived at a place called Tolstoy Farm.
Right.
Tolstoy Farm is on the other side of Lanesia, Okay, south of Lanesia. Uh-huh. Okay, there was a station nearby called Lawley Station, which is on the train line to Funabail. Okay, he used to wake up in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock, 2 a.m., put on his sandals and walk 4.5 hours one way to get to his legal practice in the CBD of Johannesburg. He used to take his staff. He used to hope that, you know, it was a full moon and there was some light. He used to put in a full day's work, and he used to walk back to Tolstoy Farm. And Tolstoy Farm was so named because Gandhi had either, I think he'd rented the land from Hermann Kallenbach, but Count Leo Tolstoy, the author, yes, also had a sort of a socialist feeling, an agrarian socialism. So it was to be for communities to be self-sufficient, to grow their own fruit trees, to plant their own grain, to work their own land, to water their own crops. And this is what they try to start at Tolstoy Farm. Now, in fairness, Gandhi didn't do this every day of the week. He did it a couple of times a week. And the farm didn't, in fact, last for very long. Gandhi's interesting. He's a sprite-like figure. He doesn't linger. He's always moving and always walking.
But, you know, him, for example, he is so tied into South Africa's history.
Absolutely.
And when you think about Gandhi, you think about this world figure, this pacifist of huge international proportions, and you think of the first independent Indian elections, and you think of all that stuff, Nehru and all the rest of it.
Yes.
But actually, he's as South African as he was Indian in many ways.
Yes, absolutely.
And he spent as much time here, but there isn't much of an appreciation even for that half the time.
Well, that's absolutely right.
Because there's a Gandhi Museum.
If you go to Tolstoy Farm...
Probably empty right now.
Yeah, if you go to Tolstoy Farm today, the initial farmhouse has been vandalized. And there's a plinth, which is still there, but then nothing remains. None of those old planted fruit trees. I visited fairly recently. And so there is this, there's this, you know, that not only is there a lack of appreciation for history, but because of the insistent needs of the urban poor, things get vandalized, they get broken down, they get...
Yeah.
Yeah.
What other things have you seen that have made you a little bit sad? Because that makes me sad to hear that about Tolstoy Farm.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd imagine some of these monuments and memorials and museums probably look terrible. Not very well.
The general answer to that, rather than a specific answer, is that the life of the rural laboring poor has not changed very much in contemporary. It's not changed with, doesn't appear to have changed.
What does that have to do with museums?
With the advent of the, what have I seen in a museum that is good?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just curious about what sort of stuff you went, oh my God, wow, that is something unexpected for someone who does read and who is interested and who does know a lot about the history of this country. What has surprised you? Because there must have been things along the way that you just thought, wow.
In the 1890s, Cape Town as a city was developing quite rapidly. And then 10 years later, the Boer War came along. There was a great, because Cape Town's a port, there was a great influx of material, people, etc. into mm-hmm. Cape Town. The founding fathers of the city realized that they had a water problem.
Yeah.
So a Scottish engineer called Thomas Stewart started building dams up on top of Table Mountain. And there are 5 dams on top of Table Mountain. Not best accessed from the top where the current cable car is, but best accessed from Constantia Neck.
Yeah.
Okay. And so nutty and so such a Victorian engineering zealot was Thomas Stewart that he built himself a little cableway at a place called Castileport, which is Kemp's Bay Way, and they took all kinds of interesting things up this cableway, including a little steam locomotive from Kilmarnock in Scotland and kegs of cement, which is the way in which cement used to be
carried
in those days. And there was a little railway line on top of Table Mountain, and the railway line was used to ferry quarried stone. the stone they used for the dam walls was quarried locally on top of Table Mountain. And they made five dams. They built five dams.
They're still there.
They're still beautiful, and they're absolute marvels of 1890s or turn of the century engineering. They're clean lined. They're aesthetically pleasing. If you get on top of Table Mountain and on a good day, you can look due east across the curve of False Bay to the Hottentots Holland Mountains and Cape Hunklip, which is 70 kilometers on the other side of False Bay on the way to Hermanus. And that thrilled me because it's beautiful, it's well preserved, and no one knows about it other than Cape Tonians.
And even only a few of them. All right, let's go to some calls here quickly, the people who want to talk to us this morning. Yeah, go ahead. Good morning, Sean.
Morning, guys.
Hey, what's up?
I want to chat about exploring South Africa and the history of it. We did a bike trip recently up to Calpinia, and we went through a place called Mikey's Fontein. Now, there's nothing else in Mikey's Fontein other than a hotel, train station, and a big house that Lord Milner used to live in. It's an interesting fact. I mean, I didn't know this. There's a cricket cup standing there. Apparently, this was the first ever cricket cup that South Africa played against England.
James Logan. James Logan is your guy,
That's it. So, you know, and these things are it's out there, but you just don't, we don't get around doing it. And we actually made a point of it, of actually stopping in all these little spots and just seeing what the little town is about. We were up on the Huntumberger. And there was an old broken bus standing there. And I thought to myself, you know, I wonder who drove this bus. And I actually asked the owner of the farm there. And he said to me that this bus, apparently, Tola van Merwe, the late Tola van Merwe, this is a bus that he drove around in. And he was driving around school kids in this thing. So, but it was all broken up. It's just, you drive past these things every day and you don't really look at them and think what the history of it, you know, or behind it is. It's just, it's absolutely amazing. I've gone through places like Karnaf and Loxton. Didn't even know these places exist in South Africa.
Yeah, it's fascinating,
but absolutely awesome. Yeah, I know, really it is. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Sean. Very good. Sean. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that Mikey's Fontein thing was like an experiment in trying to create a little, sort of a tiny little piece of Victoriana.
And was built by the son of a Scottish station master called James Logan, who arrived in the Cape probably in the 1880s. With not same old story, you know, these things come, you know, they recur quite often. And it didn't have a penny in his pocket, but he had experience working for his father in the Scottish borders, and he realized that the railways in South Africa were expanding, so he sort of. He started to work his way up the railway ladder and bought land in Mikey's Fontein. And some of the first English cricket touring sides who went up to places like Kimberley were feted and wined and dined at Mikey's Fontein. And he owned the land, he owned the hotel, and he was very, very chummy with people like Cecil John Rhodes in the early days. It's an absolute self-made man, rags to riches story. Probably didn't have a standard eight, James Logan, but he became one of the wealthiest men in the Cape Colony at the time. That's the story of Mikey's Fontein.
Well, there are lots of other stories in your book, and I encourage anybody who wants to know more about South Africa and also wants to be taken on a little journey to take a look at it. Thank you very much for coming to see us, Luke.
Thank you very much, Sunday morning,
I decided to step out and find South Africa is the book by Luke Elford, and you can get it at all good bookstores now. Isn't that what they say?
That's what they say.
There we are. Very good. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
It's the Chainsmokers and Closer. That's right. Okay, everybody, it's 19 minutes to 9. Ari and Kat coming up in a short while on Touch Central on cliffcentral.com today. We have Auto Central. That's right. You have a brand new episode of a very, very exciting car show brought to you by Auto Trader. Don't miss that between 9 and 10. And the Leadership Platform later on today with Adrian Groenewald. That's right. Ben, you've also got a show coming up today.
Yeah, Gareth, today I'm talking about the huge weekend. Also, sponsorships in sport. So I'm trying to provide some more hard-hitting, more substantial offerings in my show nowadays.
Have you had death threats since you decided to talk about sponsorships in sport? Because it's a touchy area.
I know it is. But I've got an expert coming in, and that'll be at 10 a.m. Cliff Central.
Do we know who is likely making the most money out of sponsorships in sport?
What, as per team or person?
Per person.
Well, you get people who have endorsements, but you know, then there's FIFA. Look, you can make money out of sports, and you can make money out of sports.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things on the go here.
That's on at 10 o'clock this morning, the bounce. Yeah. Okay, so back to Adrian Groenewald for a second. He'll be doing the leadership platform today, as always sponsored by Sibanye Gold. And you'll get to hear all the most important insights into leadership, the masterclass, SMEs, education, the youth leadership platform. It's everything you need and more. So don't miss any of that. And Ari and Kat coming up from 9 o'clock on Touch Central this morning with lots of good stuff too. Following them, it's Lerato Shabalala, and after Lerato, it's Dineo and O'Neill. Followed by Tibo Touch on the afternoon. Monday replenishment. That's where no matter how badly you've behaved over the weekend, you get to clear your soul. You get to do a cleansing exercise, the Monday replenishment with Tibo Touch.
Do you get to be forgiven for your sins?
You are forgiven. Totally forgiven. Lots of people still talking about UCT and WITS and the protests that they're expecting today. But I want to turn our attention to something else. You know, you got Donald Trump, who admitted in the course of last week that he's managed not to pay any tax for the last 8, 9, 10, could even be more than that, years. In fact, it's some people told me it was during the 80s that was the last time Donald Trump paid tax. Now, Christine Lagarde, who is the she's the head of the IMF, right?
Mm.
Christine Lagarde has paid no tax. She has a tax-free salary.
Oh, that's nice.
And she tells the Greeks that they must pay their tax. And she is the one who tells everybody else all over the world, pay your tax. But she doesn't pay tax. Donald Trump doesn't pay tax. I wonder how many of these really, really rich people don't pay tax, and they expect all of us who are in the middle of this to pay all the tax.
I would imagine there are probably a lot of really, really, really rich people.
I've got so many questions, but basically they all are just how?
Yeah. How do you end up paying no tax when you have, when you're earning so much money? How does this happen?
Like, what happens when the apprentice wraps for the season? Yay, guys, that's a wrap. Let's not pay tax.
How does that work?
And is it part of Christine Lagarde's job description? Is that the perks of the job?
It shouldn't be.
Well, as head of IMF, you never pay tax.
You should absolutely pay tax. I don't understand it. It's maddening to me. These are the people who tell all the rest of us to pay, but they're not.
It says here that back in 1995, Donald Trump declared a loss of nearly $1 billion right. on his income tax,
right.
thereby allowing him to legally avoid paying taxes for almost 2 decades. Legally? He's not even breaking the law here. How does that work?
Okay, I get it. So basically, because he's so terrible at business and he's just been losing his dad's money for like decades, he hasn't paid tax. Is that it?
No, he declared a loss in 1995, but that somehow allows him to not pay tax over 2 decades because of that loss that he made that 1 year.
I'll tell you what, everyone on earth hates paying tax, but it seems some people get away with it. They don't, and they manage to find a way around that. You can't live the kind of life Donald Trump lives and not pay tax. Huh?
I mean, how many people have the IRS gone after?
Yes, sis.
You know,
exactly.
Lauren Hill, Wesley Snipes.
Will Smith.
But they're not going after Donald Trump? And he's not paying tax? Do me a
DJ
favor.
DJ Jazzy Jeff.
This is outrageous.
Exactly.
MC Hammer. This is racist.
They go after everyone but
Mr. T.
These very rich people.
Did they go after Mr. T?
Well, they all get rinsed eventually. And then Donald's there. But Donald's got all these other companies. Like, surely from rental income, Like, you can't be a complete loser of everything that you can't pay tax.
He should be
capital
paying
gains.
He should be paying tax. It drives me crazy. All right, Ben wants to intro this for you. I'm just going to play a little clip of it because it's from South Park.
Yeah, because I always make reference to the fact that South Park is the greatest reference for what's happening in the world right now, and obviously the presidential election is a big deal. So Mr. Garrison is the Donald Trump character.
How is Mr. Okay, you know, I don't understand.
Yeah, you need to watch a few seasons.
How did Mr. Garrison become a bigot?
Because he's just that guy that no one likes, but he's very loud, and he believes if he talks loud over everybody, he'll get somewhere.
Plus,
which
he's
is kind
he's
of
made
American.
Friends with Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah, and he's friends with Caitlyn Jenner, who's his running partner.
All right, so this
buckle
is
up, buckaroo.
So this is Hillary.
So then, Crooked Hillary is Crooked Hillary in South Park. Okay, but now Mr. Garrison in this latest series, all he wants to do is just not be president anymore because he can't be asked. Like, it's just too much work. But everything he does that's a kind of he thinks will get him off the campaign is actually making him more popular.
So it's working against him, and he's going to end up being elected.
So here we are at the presidential debate.
Prepare you for the debates, ma'am. Just try and stay focused no matter what your opponent says.
Don't let him rattle you. He's going to do whatever he can to try and mess with your head. Don't buy into it. Whatever he says, just respond with, "My opponent is a liar and he cannot be trusted."
Got it.
Decision 2016. The first presidential debate with moderator Lester Holt.
Okay, let's get right into it. Our first question is for you, sir. How will you deal with ground troops in Syria?
Everyone, I need to just speak from the heart here. I don't know what the f*** I'm doing. Yeah. I've got to come clean. I had no idea I would get this far, but the fact of the matter is, I should not be president.
Okay, I will f*** this country up beyond repair. I'm a sick, angry little man.
Please, if you care at all about the future of our country, vote for her, okay? She's the one who at least has some experience. She's not as bad as you think, I promise. And unlike me, she's actually capable of running this country.
My opponent is a liar and he cannot be trusted.
No!
Oh my God, she is such a turd sandwich.
What he is saying is simply not true. Do not believe it.
I am giving you this, lady. I am giving you this. What the f*** are you doing? Okay, look, just vote for her. She knows politics. She really wants to put this country first.
My opponent is a liar.
Would you just please shut
and
up?
And he cannot be.
Get out of your own way.
Cannot be trusted.
Okay, look. She doesn't mean what she's saying. She just doesn't know how to take this because it's very weird and her advisors probably...
My opponent is a liar and cannot be trusted.
Why the f*** did it have to be her? I am so f***.
That's fantastic.
Oh,
you got to watch that new season just to see
right.
The self-tan on cool. Garrison's face to make him orange.
I wonder if the creators of South Park have ever had to face a lawsuit of any kind. Have they?
Many.
I'm sure
many,
they have.
I think the most famous one that they had to deal with was Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise wanted to sue them for the coming out the closet one.
Exactly.
But then, like, they're
very litigious.
So many, like, Isaac Hayes was the voice of Chef, right?
Mm.
And he didn't want to be on the show anymore because of his Scientology beliefs. So they didn't just kill his character off; they made him into a child molesting, massive pedophile rapist who then falls down a mountain and gets savaged by wolves
and bears. Yeah,
and bears.
Shame.
Oh, gosh.
Poor Isaac Hayes. It did not go well. All right, everybody. Let's wrap this thing up for this morning. Let's clear out of here. By the way, Going Digital, Mubs, is a sure way to stay relevant in show business. Stay ahead of the game at the ultimate event to business success in the creative world, the Showbiz Entertainment's Arts Africa Conference. That's right, the SEA Africa Conference, taking place on the 7th and 8th of October 2016 at Emperor's Palace. This year, the conference focuses on digital. How to use it, why it matters, how it can truly turn your artistic talent into an entrepreneurial dream come true. You can learn from industry greats like DJ Zintle, Akin Omatoso, me, Tony Joroge, and many more. Book online today at ceexpoafrica.com. That's ceexpoafrica.com. Got it? Take it down and find out more. See Africa 2016 in partnership with Touch Central, where every talent is a business. Right. damn straight. That's all you need to know for this morning. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have a great day. All right, here's what you need to know. Kim Kardashian has allegedly been held at gunpoint in her hotel room in Paris. She was unharmed, though, mostly because she's insisted on taking a selfie with a gunman, which instantly scared them off. Angelina Jolie has won temporary custody of all 23 children she acquired with soon-to-be ex-husband Brad Pitt. In what was a pretty swift process, the judge said that after playing Achilles in the movie Troy, Pitt is ultimately a lone wolf and can't be trusted long-term. Team USA won the Ryder Cup over the weekend, and Captain Davis Love III is naturally over the moon with the result. Unlike Donald Trump, Love succeeded in making America great again and didn't have to do anything racist in the process. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good day.
This is CliffCentral.com.